Hello.
Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Ian Goldsmith, the VP of Product Management for Akana at RogueWave. Ian, thanks for your time, and let's go ahead and get started, please.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. We looked up your bio, you know, on the company website and on LinkedIn, and you seem to have a very deep and rich background in helping large enterprises drive disruption while remaining focused on security. Can you kind of elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. So spent the last, 18 years or so in the Akana business. We started out called Digital Digital Evolution. There you go. That was the company was founded in 2000 on the premise that web services were coming, and along with web services were going to come some challenges. And we were set up as a software company to create software solutions to help companies solve the problems associated with the challenge of web services. Now, if you remember, and I know this is dredging way back into the dim and distant sands of time, web services were predicated on SOAP, WSDL, and UDDI. Those were basically the three legs of traditional web services. And over time, the technologies evolved, but the core constructs remain the same. And one of the biggest problems that companies faced in the early days of web services was security. The first cut at the standards for SOAP really didn't have much in the way of security. Along came the WS Star standard, specifically WS Security, and an immense amount of committee-driven complexity rolled along into the specs. And with that came massive interoperability challenges, enormous implementation challenges, and basically a borderline unusable set of specifications. Microsoft implemented every single specification in all of its gnarliest details, and essentially ensured that nothing except a Microsoft client could ever consume a service built on a Microsoft stack. IBM did something similar, but with their own bent to it. And effectively, it was really hard to make an IBM client communicate with an Oracle server or an Oracle server work with a Microsoft client and vice versa. So around that time, there was a sort of big sea change in the world of web services, where the original premise, by the way, I should have mentioned this up front, the original premise of web services was that companies were going to be able to publish their core business capabilities as services in the cloud, although I don't think the term cloud was really being heavily used back in 2000. And by publishing on the cloud, they'd enable other companies to just find them and start using them. Now, in large part due to all these the issues with security and a whole raft of other issues with SOAP, that vision never really came true. But web services started getting used heavily inside the enterprise as kind of an EAI, an enterprise application integration 2.0. And along with that came the resurgence of an architecture pattern called service-oriented architecture, or SOA. And this was now around 2005, and we at Digital Evolution were able to acquire the domain name SOA.com, so we thought it would be churlish not to change our name to SOA Software, so we did. I should point out that credit to Gartner, they told us at the time that we should not do that and that over time SOA would become unpopular, and they were right. So 10 years later, despite having a very strong leadership position in SOA governance, we changed our name again to Akana. That was 2015. And then 2 years after that, we were acquired by RogueWave and are now part of the RogueWave product portfolio, although RogueWave itself has recently been merged with a company called Perforce. So technically, we are Akana, a RogueWave company, a Perforce company, but I suspect that branding will change a little bit. Anyway, back to the technology story. So SOA as a replacement for EAI became super popular in the late 2000s and then became super unpopular by the very end of the 2000s. And around that time, basically, the problem with SOA was complexity. Everyone was the industry was fed up with the heavy-handed approach to governance that a lot of organizations were taking, the complexity of the standards. And this was the point at which the concept of APIs started coming around. So the idea behind APIs was, right, let's guess, it was right back to the original. Companies were going to be able to publish their core capabilities externally so that other companies could find them and work with them. And we had a whole bunch of very famous use cases, like Netflix being sort of poster child for API-driven business transformation and change. But there are lots and lots of others. And I'll certainly spend some time during this discussion talking about some of the other examples of API-driven disruption. And I think we have to be cognizant that there are really disruption can mean a lot of different things. So starting out with the idea that businesses are trying to disrupt their market in the way that Uber disrupted the car rental and taxi industries, in the way that Netflix, frankly, has disrupted the entertainment industry, in the way that Amazon has disrupted the retail. So you're trying to disrupt. At the same time, you're also trying to prepare yourself so you are reasonably well insulated against disruption or able to respond and react to disruption. But then there also comes the unintended consequences that you can also think of as disruption. Maybe you're T-Mobile and you leak 5 million customer records through an attack on your API. Well, that's pretty disruptive. So one of the things that a lot of organizations tend to overlook when they embark upon a digital transformation initiative is security. I've spent the majority of my career in security-focused realm, the last 18 years with Akana. We've always had a very strong, deep focus on enterprise security. Prior to that, I spent time in various agencies in and around Washington, D.C. in the U.K. with various three-letter acronyms. My master's thesis was on applied cryptography. So I have some background in the space, and I understand that it's not sexy or exciting, but it's super important. That may be the longest answer to any single question you've ever had, but there we go.
Okay, well, it's awesome. Now, I think you may have segued into this, but I'll still ask it anyway. Can you provide just a little bit more background on Akana?
On Akana, yeah, sure. So I sort of gave the history. We evolved from web services management into SOA governance. In about 2012, we pivoted to API management, and that's been our deep focus ever since. We're pretty much universally considered as the security leader in API management. So API management covers a range of SINs, from straight out proxies through gateway features, through orchestration and mediation and transformation, developer portals. One of the core features in any gateway is its security capabilities. In a recent report from Forrester Research, we received the highest score of any of the vendors for security. And that's basically reflective of our strong focus on that space. We have a lot of customers in the banking world where security is a critical part of anything that they deploy. At this point, we offer our API management platform both as a SaaS service, as on-premise software, or as a hybrid deployment. You can leverage our cloud platform for all of the central services, analytics, all the data storage configuration, and host your own gateways that are configured and driven and report back to our cloud platform. So we have an extremely rich set of technology. It's evolved over the last 19 years. So there's a huge amount of intellectual property poured into the platform at this point.
Okay, sounds excellent. Now, does Akana have a presence in other countries as well too?
Yeah, we do. Actually, we're truly global. We have presence in, I'm trying to think if we're missing a continent. I don't believe we are. I'm struggling to remember the seven continents. But we do. We have customers in every continent at this point. We're particularly strong in North America and Europe. We're an American company. We founded out of Los Angeles, currently headquartered out of Louisville, Colorado, with Rogue Wave. But we've always had a pretty good presence in Europe. We have sales channels in other parts of the world and support organizations. Our technical services are distributed globally. We actually have a major development center in Tallinn, Estonia, which is also one of our customer support locations. So we offer 24/7 follow-the-sun support. It's a particularly interesting question when you ask it in the context of our SaaS platform. We actually run three completely separate SaaS environments, one called Smoke Test, which is basically where our continuous integration system deploys new builds automatically into Smoke. So the Smoke Test environment is updated very frequently. And then when we determine that a build is good to go live, we notify customers, and within 24 hours, we update our other two environments. And the other two environments are an environment called Global, which has a presence in US Northwest, US East, and EU East, and a second environment called EU, which has a presence in EU West and EU East. Now, the purpose of the EU environment is to help our customers comply with EU data privacy laws, where there are a number of laws that prevent data from being hosted outside the EU. And so our EU environment allows customers to ensure that they're able to comply with that environment while taking advantage of a SaaS platform. One of the things that's quite unique about the way that we deploy and build the product is that our platform is truly globalized. So if you look at our global platform, for example, I mentioned three different hosting centers. But basically, your view of the platform is identical whichever of those centers you connect to from an administrative and configuration perspective. You have distinct gateway clusters, we call them deployment zones, in each region that you can choose to host your APIs in, and you can use global traffic management technologies like Akamai or Amazon Route 53 to provide location-based DNS services so that your customers will always be routed to the nearest available instance of your API. One of the beauties of the way that we run the platform is that in the event of a complete data center outage, which is incredibly rare, but let's say the Pacific Northwest suffered a massive earthquake and fell into the ocean, our other two data centers would just seamlessly continue the load. We have a multi-master replication platform that ensures that all systems are always identical, or within an eventual consistency-based model are identical within about half a second for any configuration change. So it's pretty resilient platform that we run, which is part of the reason why that EU data center is so important for customers in Europe, where data is replicated instantly to all other hosting centers in that region. So were they to use our global system, they could host their APIs in our EU East data center, but any metrics and data collected, recorded messages, audit data, would automatically be replicated back to our other data centers for resiliency purposes, and that might in turn violate EU privacy law.
Excellent. Now, who is your typical customer base that you're trying to target? Is the small to medium-sized business, the large companies, like a Fortune 500, or could be a mixture of both?
We're not exclusively large enterprise, but to all intents and purposes, we are. And what I mean by that is that our sales model is oriented to large opportunity, large customer deals. The way that works is that we run almost exclusively a direct model, except in some other parts of the world. So in Africa, in Asia Pacific, we'll use channels, but we're still targeting large customers. The main reason for that is that our ideal customer is someone who has a diverse technology platform, a great deal of complexity, a huge amount of risk in the event of security violations, vulnerabilities, and typically organizations that build a lot of their own solutions. And those kinds of companies tend to be on the larger end. The reason I say we're not exclusive to larger companies is there is a class of company that fits our profile which is a company that may be smaller, but their entire business is predicated upon their API. I mean, an example of that would be somebody like Autodata, who are the largest provider of pricing data about cars in North America. They're not that large an organization, but their entire business depends on the API. So they're a great customer for someone like us. Or a Fleetmatics, who are now known as Verizon Connect, mm-hmm. out of Republic of Ireland. They're another great example of the kind of customer that may not be the largest in the world, but still requires the type of technology we provide. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, our customers are large enterprise, Fortune 500 or larger.
Okay, excellent. Now, you've got an API management piece pretty good, but can you describe more how it's used in cybersecurity? And are your solutions made available on-prem or in the cloud, or can it be on both?
Yeah, so API management and cybersecurity is let's take that one first. It's the security capabilities of the API management solution are probably the most valuable thing that our customers get from the solution. So effectively, what you're doing is rehosting APIs in our gateway. So the API endpoint that any customer would communicate with would be hosted on our gateway. And the gateway then uses various different secure mechanisms, sometimes relatively simple things like HTTPS mutual authentication to connect to the internal services themselves. But the actual API is hosted on our gateway. And then the gateway has an incredibly rich library of policies, so customers can decide which policies they're going to connect to their APIs or which policies they're going to associate with their APIs so that the gateway will enforce those policies. And that's sort of covers the sort of five big ones. So authentication, authorization, privacy, non-repudiation, and audit. Those are really the big security-centric policies that people will attach. So authentication, authorization in the modern world are typically handled by the OAuth specification. So if you're using OAuth 2.0, perhaps you're using OpenID Connect to authenticate end users against identity providers. In an ideal world, you're using OpenID Connect with JWT, so JSON Web Tokens. You're probably, or you should in an ideal world, be using JWKS to ensure that those tokens are signed with valid certificates. You get into the token side of OAuth that for identity token. And then within the OAuth spec, you have a huge range of different ways that you can authenticate and authorize. But the ideal sort of authorization construct is using, again, JSON Web Tokens for OAuth authorization tokens. And that gives you an extremely efficient way for the gateway to process and determine whether a consumer is authorized to access an API or not. So OAuth is kind of the dominant specification in the rest of the world, but there are lots and lots of other ways, just from simple HTTP basic auth, app key or API key, as some people call it, HMAC signature of API keys, ranging through all of the WS security specifications for SOAP. A huge range of things that can be handled for authentication authorization. Then you get into signing and encryption. JSON has the JOSE specification, JSON object signing and encryption. So allowing the gateway to enforce that messages are signed and validate signatures and reject messages with invalid signature or that are unsigned. Allow the gateway to verify that requests are encrypted appropriately, and if they're not, reject them. Ideally, the gateway would not be responsible for decrypting content. That should be end-to-end, and that's really the purpose of the JOSE specification. But still, the gateway should be responsible for validating that data that is supposed to be encrypted is encrypted. That's sort of signing encryption. Non-repudiation is handled by signature. So privacy is the way encryption handles privacy. And then auditing, there's a huge range of different policies that you can associate with an API to determine what gets audited and how. And actually, from a security construct or context, what doesn't get audited is just as important as what does. If you're in a PCI world, you should never audit PAN data. You should never store credit card data in audit logs, for example. So making sure that your audit data is it complies with various regulatory specs is just as important as what you're auditing in the first place. So the gateway provides that surface area, allowing API developers to not have to worry about security at all. As an API developer, I'm concerned about with my business logic. I'm creating APIs that deliver valuable business content and capabilities to my customers being developers. And I delegate the security aspects, essentially I delegate all of the non-functional aspects of my API to the API management layer. Does that kind of cover that question?
Yep, sounds excellent.
Now, the technical architecture, can you elaborate a little more on that for your solutions?
I'm sorry, I missed that question, Ravi.
It's about the technical architecture. Can you tell us more about that for your solutions that you have?
Yeah, sure. So our product is a Java platform. So we're built on OSGI. We have our own fairly heavily customized version of the Felix OSGI container. We leverage, again, a fairly heavily customized Jetty container to handle our HTTPS termination. We're built using a JBI architecture, so JBI being JSR 208, but again, fairly heavily modified. JBI is interesting because it uses a normalization construct, where basically inbound requests are normalized and put on a normalized message router where they're routed to an appropriate app. Off-ramp, it's called. And the off-ramp then reserializes the message in whatever format's required. However, that's not very efficient. If your upstream and downstream services are using the same formats and the same protocols, there's really no need to normalize. And so by not normalizing the request and simply streaming through the gateway, we can achieve a huge amount of efficiency. But so the gateway functions on that using that modified optimized JBI construct, where the on-ramps and off-ramps for JBI handle all of the policy implementation and enforcement. The policy is being enforced on the on-ramps before a request comes into the gateway, and policy being implemented on the off-ramp before it goes out into the wild world downstream. The beauty of that is that the developers of APIs are completely abstracted from that concept. It's entirely declarative. As an administrator of the gateway, when I assign a policy to a service, it's going to be enforced. When there's a policy on a downstream service, we're going to implement it, if we can. So there are things you can't do, right? So give you an example of that. If we receive an inbound request that is authenticated using SAML or OAuth, for example, i.e. an opaque token, then and on the downstream side, I'm expected to implement an HTTP basic auth header. I can't. I have no way of doing that because I don't have the user's password. But if I have basic auth coming in, I do have the user ID and the password, and I can pretty much implement anything downstream. So we have a very sophisticated mechanism for identity mediation, protocol mediation, so REST to SOAP, SOAP to REST, JSON to XML, XML to JSON, all of those things are pretty seamless within the gateway. And then the gateways are all stateless. You can run them in clusters behind load balancers. That's a typical deployment pattern. You load starts growing too much, and the CPU use across the gateway cluster is too high, so we'll simply add another one to the cluster. It'll automatically configure itself and start processing traffic. They're supported by a set of centralized infrastructure. We call it the API platform. The API platform consists of really two things, a component called Policy Manager and a component called Community Manager. Policy Manager provides the supporting infrastructure for the gateways, so security token services, XKMS-based PKI key and certificate distribution mechanisms, gateway configuration services, all of those things. So when a gateway starts up, it connects to policy manager and say, hey, here's my ID. What am I? And policy manager says, okay, well, based on your ID, you belong to this tenant, and you're supposed to be hosting these services. And the gateway then says, okay, well, for each service, tell me what I'm supposed to do. And it builds its configuration incrementally. Takes a few seconds. Then the other component of the centralized infrastructure is the community manager product. And that's basically the developer portal. That's where API and app developers interact with the platform for defining and configuring APIs and creating apps, configure and finding APIs for their apps to connect with. It's a self-service platform that's designed to take away a lot of the complexity of API design, development, and app connection.
Sounds excellent. Now, can you describe in more detail how your services can protect APIs from the different threat classes?
Yeah, sure. There's a whole raft of different attack vectors for APIs. I kind of covered the basics with authentication, authorization, privacy through encryption, signature to manage and provide non-repudiation, and audit. But there's a whole bunch of other things. So if you look at the OWASP top 10, that really defines the typical sets of vulnerabilities that web applications are subject to. But most of those also apply to APIs. So you've got cross-site scripting attacks. You've got cause origin-based attacks. You've got a whole raft of denial of service type attacks. You've got malware and antivirus. A pretty common attack type for both websites and APIs is SQL injection and script injection. You have to ensure that someone's not sending a JavaScript command through an API that could be run in the back end of an application to do all sorts of damage. You have to ensure someone's not sending a SQL select statement through an API. Now, I mean, ideally, modern applications should be built well enough that they should ignore all of that stuff anyway, but you never know, and that's a pretty common attack vector that people have exploited for all sorts of bad means. So it's not enough to just protect the API by ensuring that only authorized users are allowed to access it, because unfortunately, a fairly high proportion of attacks come from authorized users. There's a huge number of insider-based attacks that are attacking applications. So an API gateway can provide all of the various different threat protection features. We have integrated antivirus using ICAPS to connect to whatever antivirus service you may have in your organization. We have script injection, SQL injection. We have a whole bunch of pattern matching technologies. We have document attacks, so XML bomb type stuff. People who are using overly deep schemas or too much recursion for both XML and JSON will provide a pretty broad set of mechanisms allowing you to detect and prevent those attacks. We have denial of service attack detection and prevention through quota management and throttling policies. We also integrate with network level DDoS solutions. So our SaaS platform is deployed on Amazon. We use Amazon Advanced Security to handle DDoS protection. So there's a huge range of capability sets that the gateway both leverages and provides to ensure that the backend APIs are secure. I mean, honestly, one of the things that most customers really have to ensure they protect themselves against is too much success. That sounds kind of weird, but if you publish an API that's designed to allow customers to access a back-end application, and the back-end application is designed to handle 100 requests a second, now all of a sudden a new application starts growing in popularity, and all of a sudden you've got 10,000 customers trying to use it, and at peak periods they're putting 1,000 requests a second on it. Well, guess what? Your back end's going to die. So again, the API gateway can protect you against that. It can, A, provide you the audit data to tell you, hey, yeah, this thing's been pretty successful. There's a lot of growth here. You better get ready for that and start provisioning some more capability internally. But it can also apply throttling policies and capabilities to prevent that kind of overage from bringing your application down.
Sounds good. Now we know that mobile security is a big hot button issue topic today. You know, I mean, it seems like the wireless smartphones are an extension of our brain and just our personal lives, professional lives, and what have you. What are your thoughts on that, on mobile security? I know it's a general question, but just if you can throw out your two cents, what you have on that, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. I mean, mobile apps and APIs go hand in hand. Mobile apps use APIs for almost all of their integration with business services, and apps that are just a simple extension of a website don't really buy you a lot. They don't really add a lot of value. So there are a number of challenges associated with consuming APIs and mobile apps. I'm not going to get into the development concerns and the issues around, well, if someone reverse engineers the app on the phone or decompiles the app on the phone, they can get hold of my app key and therefore get access to the API pretending they're me. That's a whole different class of issue than the stuff we're talking about. From the API perspective, we help ensure that the way apps use APIs is secure. So OAuth is still the technology of choice. In some cases, you're able to leverage three-legged OAuth by redirecting customers to authentication services like Auth0 or Facebook or Google to authenticate and grant authentication access so the app can authenticate against a third-party service. In other cases, you have to use something called client credentials or resource owner credentials where the credentials are provided directly to the app. That's certainly not a best practice. We highly recommend the use of three-legged technologies where you can. Not always practical, but where you can. And then obviously the things like Jose, JSON Object Sign Encryption, really important. Or if you find that the effort required to perform the mathematical operations for encryption and signature in JavaScript are too onerous or too expensive for the device you're using, then at least make sure you're using HTTPS. In general, the combination of OAuth over HTTPS provides a pretty secure wire protocol. I'm sure there are people jumping up and screaming at me right now for that statement, but it's one I'm willing to stand by with a reasonable degree of faith. So in general, the things that we've talked about already for API security apply directly to mobile app security. By the way, I completely agree with you about the importance of mobile security and also the phones being extensions of your brain. I thought I'd lost my phone while sitting in a lift back from LAX last night, and the panic was unbelievable. I thought I was going to have a heart attack.
Okay.
And then I just found it in my jacket pocket instead of my pants pocket, and it was like, oh, God, the relief. Anyway, different story.
Yeah. I've been through that before, you know, like when you're a smartphone, you lose network connectivity or for some reason it just, I've been through it with my old iPhone. Believe me, I completely understand where that comes from. Now, can you tell us more about the PKI services, how this is made as a service offering, and is it on-prem as well too?
Yeah, so the product includes a built-in certificate authority. We can act as a root CA or a subordinate CA. We have key issuing management, revocation list management. One of the kind of the secret sources in all of this is we've used an extended version of the XKMS specification to manage the distribution of key pairs and certificates around the various different components of the platform. So I already kind of talked a little bit about how when a gateway starts up, it presents its ID to the policy manager infrastructure and says, this is who I am, tell me what I'm supposed to be doing. Well, part of that is that ID it presents is a seed into a fairly complex dance by which the gateway actually retrieves its own PKI credentials from policy management. It uses those credentials for subsequent communication. Very, very sophisticated mechanism built into that. That PKI construct is available both on-prem and in the cloud. It's part of our core product. So we act as a CA. We publish all of the keys and certificates and manage them all on behalf of the customer. So as a customer, you don't really ever have to worry about what you're doing with keys and certs. It's just part of the platform, and they're all managed for you relatively seamlessly. You have to be aware of expiry of the externally facing certificates that you're publishing. So if you have a developer.acme.com and api.acme.com domains, and you're using one cert with a CN and a SAN for those two hosts, then and that cert expires, and you better make sure that you've replaced it with a new version before it expires, or you're going to start getting certificate errors on any connection request. But the product handles the distribution management of the individual infrastructure components, certificates, and keys seamlessly.
Excellent. Sounds excellent. Now, can you tell us about your authentication services? Do you make use of biometrics? That's actually my sweet spot right there. So feel free to talk about each of this as you want. I mean, I can tell you I've written three books published. This is my, after cybersecurity, this is my next area of love. So do you make use of biometrics in this regard? Feel free to go away on this.
We can, right? I mean, we're not an identity provider. We're a consumer of identity. So I mentioned the OAuth three-legged dance, and things like Auth0 or Active Directory might be a good example. Let's say I am using a mobile app, and and that app needs to consume an API, and I haven't previously been granted access, or I haven't granted this application access to that API. Well, the first thing that's going to happen is my app's going to try and connect to the API, and it'll get redirected to an authentication service, ideally something using OpenID Connect. When that the actual mechanism for authentication that the user goes through is out of scope for the OpenID Connect and OAuth dance. So basically, I'd get redirected to an identity provider, and let's say it's Azure AD, and that Azure AD instance is configured for, let's keep it simple, let's just say it's 2FA. So I log in, I present my password, and it says, we've sent you an authentication request to your phone. And if you're using the Microsoft Authenticator app, you can just hit the approve button after you log in, which in the case of using an Apple device, you're probably using your thumbprint or Face ID. So you are engaging with biometrics at that point, right? But it's outside our scope. Effectively, the token that we're provided by the identity system is all we care about. We don't care whether that token required biometric or not. That's the realm of the identity provider. And that's as it should be. We don't want to be an identity provider. We're in the business of securing your APIs, not managing your identities, in the same way that the identity providers should stick to managing identity and they shouldn't try to secure APIs.
Okay, excellent. Now, going back to your company, do you have any customer success stories that you'd like to share with us? Do you have any case studies, testimonials that you can share on behalf of your customers that our audience can listen to?
Sure. So most of our customers, being large enterprise, are a bit shy about use of their names, but I'll kind of try and talk in abstract terms about a few different customers. I mean, one is a very large heavy equipment manufacturer who has created what at this point is far and away the world's leading agronomic data platform. Effectively, the agriculture equipment they make is all heavily instrumented. They collect an enormous amount of data about soil, nutrient levels, moisture levels, as the equipment plows a field. So a farmer will have a tractor or combine or whatever it may be out in the field. And when it comes back home after a five-day session plowing a massive field, there'll be an enormous amount of data for every square foot of soil or cubic foot of soil that it's touched. And that data will get uploaded into a huge data warehouse at our customer. And then they've created a developer ecosystem where partners can create apps that connect to that data. So the idea is that as a farmer, I can go to, I don't know, Monsanto, Cargill, Bayer, BASF, or various universities or various specialized agronomic providers, and I can say, hey, I'm a customer of manufacturer X, and I've got all this data in their warehouse, and I'd like to share with you data from my fields 3, 4, and 5. And I want you to tell me what to plant, when to plant it, what kind of fertilizers to use, when I should fertilize, what my watering schedule should look like. But it's even more sophisticated than that, because what you actually get back from, let's say it's Monsanto, what you actually get back from that application is what our customer calls a prescription, which now is a file that you load into your seeding machine. And so when you go out to seed the fields that you shared data for, it's going to provide precise amounts of seed in various different parts of the field based on the data that it gathered about that field. Because some areas might be moister, some might be less moist, some might be rockier, some might have higher levels of nutrients. So based on the data that it's collected about the various areas of the field, it will know how much seed to use to optimize efficiency. And this is a super cool story, right? Because the top line message around all of this is, hey, this kind of technology, digital agriculture, and particularly this type of application, is how we're going to feed the world's growing population. I mean, the world's there's all sorts of different stats on this, but basically by the end of this century, we're going to be relatively static population terms, around 10 billion. That's about the number that we think. But that means that we're going to have to be feeding 2.5 times as many people as we're feeding today with less land, realistically. So how's that going to happen? Well, it's this kind of technology that's going to enable that. Plus, it means that growers are more efficient, and it takes a very small increase in efficiency to drive substantial change in your financial situation as a large commercial farmer. It allows the partners of our customers, so the people who built these apps, it allows them to sell more seed, to sell more fertilizer, to provide their customers with the kind of guidance that makes their services and capabilities stickier. And it helps our customer sell more of its own equipment. So, I mean, overall, it's an absolutely incredible story of a 300-year-old company that has leveraged digital technology and transformed itself or used disruptive technology to take a dominant leadership position in a particular industry. Another example would be a large international bank that's being driven initially by regulation, but now by internal desire down an open banking path. I don't want to spend too long on open banking, but basically Europe has a specification called PSD2, Payment Services Directive 2. The UK created a kind of advanced version of that called UK Open Banking. And the UK said, okay, we need to get ahead of the game on this. So they identified the 9 largest banks, technically 8 banks in the building society in the UK, and they said, you guys are all going to have to meet a certain set of deadlines for meeting our open banking spec. And basically what open banking says is, as a large bank, you need to API enable your back-end systems to surface account information services and payment initiation services, so that fintech organizations can build cool applications on top of your platform. The goal being to drive better services and better capabilities for customers, but in the process, it actually does a lot. It helps the banks become more agile and compete more effectively. It helps the banks understand their customers better by seeing what kind of reception various different fintechs get. It helps the fintechs because it gives them the ability to integrate with the banks to service their business models, and it helps customers. So we have one of the premier examples of a UK open banking client using our platform for all of the technology infrastructure to host their external APIs and their external developer portal. And there's a massive focus on security there. One of the things that's particularly challenging in that environment is that they have some very stringent requirements around the security aspects of their deployment. So they require the use of a hardware security module for all cryptographic operation, for example, which can certainly change the dynamic around how a gateway works. There are plenty more examples there. We've got a company that essentially provides OnStar type services for fleets. So if you're if you have a large fleet of trucks that you operate, and you want to understand where they are at all times, and whether the drivers are abusing them, and what their maintenance health is, and if they need an oil change, and all of that kind of stuff, then all of that data is collected by onboard telematics and is published via APIs to you, the fleet manager, so that you can build applications to track and monitor and manage your own fleet. We have a whole raft of different customers across different technology spaces using the product in various different security environments, including a number of European retail organizations who are bound by very stringent GDPR constraints. So it's a technology that is becoming increasingly critical in inside the enterprise. I actually just spent 2.5 days at a Chief Information Security Officer conference in Scottsdale, Arizona. And a lot of the conversation was around compliance and how you can help your organization achieve compliance. And one of the critical things there is we have to understand and control all of your ingress and egress points. And firewalls just don't do that anymore. Even web application firewalls is not enough. You have to understand what's going on and be able to control who is accessing what through your APIs, because you're going to have APIs. Even if you don't today, you're certainly going to soon.
Sounds excellent. Now, as we know, I've interviewed many cybersecurity companies, and there's a plethora of them, all over the world and here in the U.S. What separates Akana from the other API management vendors? In other words, why should a customer come to you first versus anybody else?
Yeah, well, our top differentiator is security. It sounds a bit trite to use one word as a differentiator, but when you look at the way analysts rate the various different vendors, we inevitably come top in security. There's really no other API management vendor that offers the depth and breadth of security capability that we offer. So, that's one, is our security capabilities. Our portal is very dynamic. So when you create a new API, it's immediately published to the portal. The portal is essentially a window into the configuration of the gateways, which means there's never any enormous development effort required to publish an API to the portal. You don't have to have a whole bunch of web developers creating a website for your APIs. I could go on and on about our security differentiation. The integrated OAuth server is a huge part of it. Global performance and scale. Our product is designed from its core to be distributed globally. That's actually a very difficult thing to do, and we've put a lot of effort into the technology backbone that we sit on that enables that. And I think a big part of it, too, is our expertise. We remain an independent entity. Yes, we were acquired by Rogue Wave, but we, Akana, still have the same team, same engineers, the same expertise. And a lot of us have been doing this for a very long time. We have a lot of institutional expertise around APIs, an enormous amount of knowledge. It's consistently one of the things we hear from our customers is, man, your team knows their stuff. And I think that helps immensely versus some of the other players that have been swallowed up by larger organizations, and you get a natural a dilution of talent as people move on to other opportunities.
Okay. Now, do you offer any free trials or any type of free risk assessment tools for the customer before they come on board or before they purchase your products and services?
Yeah, we do. We allow customers to trial the product both in our SaaS platform and via on-prem evaluations. We try to work those evaluations through our sales organization to help ensure that the customer has the best experience. API technologies in general, particularly when you start looking at the security side of it, become quite complex. And it's it's not an easy technology to sort of pick up and say, oh, okay, I get it. So having an initial couple of hours of demonstration to help get you started is really important. So we typically ask our customers to engage with our sales team and pre-sales engineers to get a good jump start on the evaluation.
Okay. Uh-oh. Now, does the federal government make use of your products and services as well, too?
We actually have a couple of federal government customers. The General Services Administration is one of them. We have quite a lot of state governments as well. I'm not sure that I'm at liberty to say which, but certainly two of the very largest states use our product extensively in a number of different parts of their governments. Where we haven't put any energy is in the military side of things. There are a number of compliance requirements in military that are just extremely expensive to go after, things like common criteria. And it's unless you have an entree into that space, it's just not it's not really worth the energy and effort to apply. So we have a lot of government clients, but nothing in military defense at this point.
Thank you. Excellent. No, I'm not going to get political in this next question, but we keep hearing about the nation-state threat actors like North Korea, China, Russia, and Russian meddling with the 2016 elections. Now it's proven that there was no collusion. I don't know. I mean, I have my views, but I try to stay apolitical, on the cyber as a cybersecurity professional. But what are your thoughts on that? If you want to get political,
I'm an English guy, English guy living in Southern California. It's not too hard to gauge my view on things, but I try not to get too deeply into that. My belief is that we're already in World War III, and we're losing. We have nation state actors that are putting an enormous amount of their time and energy into hacking. Most of it, I believe, is commercial. I don't think there's a great deal of attempts to disrupt civilian infrastructure, but there's an enormous amount attempts to steal information or disrupt a business through cyber mechanisms, and whether that's coming from Russia or China or North Korea, I don't really have much opinion on that. But it's kind of interesting to visit Akamai's corporate headquarters and stand in their lobby looking at they have some giant screens sitting inside their NOC, which is directly behind the reception desk, and they have some really interesting graphics showing the source of a huge amount of the malicious traffic that's flowing, and there's a huge amount of it coming out of Russia and China. But that's not really my forte. I focus on helping enterprises stay above the fray of that kind of stuff and securely disrupt themselves or their industries to do better in their business using technologies like APIs, but doing it in a way that allows them to ensure their own safety and security.
Okay. What are your general plans for expansion? Are you planning to offer new products, new services, or enter newer markets, or perhaps a mixture of both?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because having been acquired by Rogue Wave and then Perforce, we actually have a lot more money behind us than we would have done a couple of years ago. So we're kind of looking at what the next step holds for us. And there are a number of quite interesting technology opportunities for us that will allow us to launch new products into adjacent markets or extensions of the API management market. I know that we don't have any immediate plans to change our go-to-market model. So we're still looking at that same large enterprise offer the best product to the best people kind of approach. But that doesn't mean that won't change in the future. But I certainly see some interesting opportunities to leverage machine learning in some aspects of API security. And there are a few other things that I don't really want to get into outside of some nice non-disclosures.
Okay. Now, let's just go, and as we come close to wrapping up the show, let's go into the cybersecurity threat landscape in general. How do you see it changing and evolving in the coming years? I mean, we keep hearing about ransomware, Bitcoin attacks, crypto mining, crypto jacking. I mean, I just wrote a blog piece on for another client on just like document malware. You know, I mean, it's like an old mechanism for a threat vector, but there's so many variants of it coming out. What are your thoughts on that?
Again, it's kind of outside of my area of expertise. But what I'll say, based on kind of a career spent in this realm, is that we have to expect the unexpected. The threats evolve constantly, and I evolve may not even be the right word. It may be there are revolutions in threats on a pretty regular basis. I think all you can do is to ensure that you take as many precautions as you can to create the most secure environment that you can create. The goal is you can never ensure 100% safety. I mean, the only 100% safe network is the one that's turned off. And I think there's definitely a sense that security organizations can have a bit of a reputation for being business prevention teams. And you have to avoid that, right? You have to find that happy balance between finding the best technologies to accelerate your business and keeping yourself safe. So I mean, I tend to operate on the least paranoid, most practical approach that I can, which sort of typically means, well, you know, if you have a car and you have to leave it in a dodgy neighborhood, then use both the car alarm and a club. The two things together don't stop the thief from taking your car. They just make it easier for them to steal the car next to you. So make your organization just that little bit more difficult to get at than the other one by closing the obvious gaps. Don't make stupid mistakes. You know, just sort of, if you avoid tripping yourself up, then you'll probably stay on your feet. It's a bit like playing a round of golf, really. It's not about the great shots you hit, it's about the absence of the bad ones. And I think that security is probably the ultimate example of that.
Okay. Now, based from your deep experience in cybersecurity, what do you think the biggest cyber threat will be here in 2019?
Well, a bit self-serving, but I honestly think that we're going to see a significant acceleration in API-led attacks, attacks on companies' APIs. We saw it in 2018. It was really 2018 was the first year that we saw substantial attacks. Google suffered a big attack. Salesforce had a big attack. T-Mobile, number of companies had pretty big cyber attacks that were via their API surface areas. And I think that the reason for that is that APIs are now so much in the mainstream that it's quite easy to find a company's API. And if you are able to compromise it, you can get huge amounts of data really, really quickly, or do huge amounts of damage really, really quickly because the API is designed to be used programmatically. So I think we're going to see those types of attacks accelerate significantly. I'm talking about this from an enterprise security perspective, right? I'm not talking about the general like the emails that warn you that your computer's been compromised and I've got your password and I've enabled your camera and all that stuff. That's just yet another class of phishing type email. Those are certainly not played out by any stretch of the imagination, nor are the phone calls from an agent of the Social Security Administration telling you your Social Security number's been hacked. That stuff's going to continue until basically people wise up and figure out that it's kind of dumb to fall for those things. But I think we're going to start seeing the bad actors going after APIs more and more. And, you know, as the world becomes more and more automated, there'll be more and more damage you can do by compromising somebody's API. And I think that the combination of API, IoT, and AI is going to make for some pretty interesting potential outcomes.
Okay. Now, finally, our last question here. I keep getting asked, and in turn, I keep asking all my podcast guests, what are the top few things you recommend people to protect themselves and businesses from becoming a victim of cyber attack? I know it's a very general question, but what do you do to protect yourself? Let me ask you that.
Well, I think the first thing you do is ensure that your organization has a security posture. We have a chief information security officer. He's entirely focused on ensuring that our business is safe. He's put in place a set of policies and procedures, ensured that he's enforced the implementation of two-factor authentication through the enterprise, much to the distress of people who get logged out while they're on a plane, for example. But you know what? It keeps us much more substantially safe than it used to. We've put in place all sorts of secure enclaves and network layers and all sorts of things. But I mean, it's kind of easy for us, right? We're a smaller organization. We're a few hundred people. It's a little bit easier for us to govern and manage all of these things. I think the most important thing you can do is be aware of the risks and understand how to mitigate them. If you're a large enterprise, you'd better have an understanding of what you're doing for API security. In the same way that it's inconceivable that any large enterprise today would not have network firewalls and probably web application firewalls. You've got to have API security in the same level as that. It's that same kind of technology footprint and understanding. I think that at the end of the day, it comes down to focus and having a pragmatic approach to protecting yourselves. And the biggest part of it is understanding what the risks are, understanding the threat points, and just general awareness. So evaluate, follow standard frameworks. The NIST framework, great. ISO 27001, solid framework. If you're in the payment card industry, you have to comply with PCI. There's a whole bunch of different frameworks out there that provide guidelines. And even if you don't go for a formal audit and certification, ensure that you follow the guidelines, and it'll at least tell you what you need to be aware of and what you need to understand. And if you're an individual, tell the guy who says he's an agent of the Social Security Administration your Social Security number. Don't send the guy from Nigeria $1,000 because he's promised to send you $10,000. Use your brain. Use your brain, and that'll help a lot.
Okay. Well, Ian, we thank you so much for your time this evening. We look forward to talking with you again here in the near future. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Robbie. Enjoy the session.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye.